Welcome back to Headnote, the corporate litigation podcast brought to you by Pinsent Masons and Outlaw. This podcast is being presented by three speakers, myself, Andrew Herring, and Faye Moore and Jim Richards. I'm a senior associate in our commercial litigation team, and I specialise in high-value complex contractual disputes.
My name's Faye Moore. I'm a senior associate in commercial litigation. I've got a wide range of experience in commercial disputes, including breach of contract, warranty claims, and post-completion disputes.
My name is Jim Richards. I'm a litigation partner, particularly interested in contractual disputes and injunctive relief.
So before we get into the detailed topics that we want to discuss today, we've just got two or three recent developments that we think our listeners are going to be very interested in. I'm going to kick off with the first one, which is that Lord Justice Briggs' final report into the future of the civil courts structure was published at the end of July. And although this might seem quite a dry topic, there are a number of key points coming out of it which are going to have quite a big impact on how court disputes are managed in the future. So some of the key recommendations have included establishing an online court, and that's initially going to be for money claims of up to £25,000. They're also, one of the recommendations is to increase the minimum threshold for commencing claims in the High Court, and that's initially going to be to £250,000 and subsequently to £500,000. Some of the routine judge work is intended to go to trained case officers, and that's to free up judicial resource to focus mainly on the trials and writing judgments. And the county court's going to become the default court for enforcement of judgments and orders.
I'm just going to talk a little bit about electronic filing. Back in 2010, the Jackson Report recommended the introduction of an effective IT system for the courts. There's been a pilot scheme for voluntary electronic filing in the Technology Court since April 2015, and that was extended to all London courts since November 2015. And there's now been talk about making this compulsory in all London courts rather than just a voluntary scheme, which has been to date. The timing for this is a bit unclear at the moment, but it's potentially from as early as April 17.
So I'm just going to talk about an issue which I think is very important for commercial parties considering litigating in the UK, and that's a Brexit issue. It's a key issue around the enforcement of judgments in the EU. Parties tend to come to the UK because of the calibre of judges, the full disclosure powers which are available, and indeed the ease of the enforcement of a UK English judgment in other jurisdictions, particularly in the EU. And at the moment, the position is that an English judgment can be enforced with relative ease in any EU member state. So, as I said, the current position is that for judgments before the 10th of January 2015, they are governed by the Brussels 1 regulations and are not just confined to monetary judgments, but all kinds of different judgments. And there is that ease of enforcement in the EU. After the 10th of January, there is something called the Reset Brussels Regulations, which encompasses a number of improvements to that. So what's going to be the situation if no agreement is reached by the with the EU on the reciprocal enforcement of judgments post-Brexit? Then I think we would be looking at falling back on local EU member rules. So one would be looking at the jurisdiction rules of each member state. That could be much more restrictive. And it's a major issue for a commercial party who has chosen English law and English jurisdiction. If they find that any judgment they obtain, they can't enforce it with ease in the EU. But I think the message is that that there is a degree of uncertainty at the moment until the position is clarified. It may well lead to more arbitration. I think, and one hopes, the government won't overlook this because the ease of enforcing judgments abroad obviously has significant ramifications for commercial parties.
Well, thanks again for listening to the Headnote podcast brought to you by Pinsent Masons and Outlaw. You can find full case names and citations in the introductory note where you downloaded the podcast. We hope you're enjoying it. Please let us know by emailing in any feedback to headnote@pinsentmasons.com. So moving on to our first topic for this podcast, which is dealing with two recent decisions of the Court of Appeal, which have settled previously conflicting case law about variation of contracts. And the lead case now on anti-oral variation clauses is called MWB Business Exchange Centres. And that reaches the same conclusion in principle as another case in May this year called Global Motors Incorporated. This decision is going to be especially important in the case of IT and construction agreements, which generally include strict change control procedures.
So I guess the first question is, what is an anti-oral variation clause? It's an express clause that sets out whether one or more parties to an agreement can amend its terms and what procedure must be followed to vary it. Generally, an anti-oral variation clause restricts variation of an agreement to variations agreed in writing between the parties, and they're quite common provisions in commercial contracts.
So why are we saying that this is settling previously conflicting case law? Well, unfortunately, there were two Court of Appeal decisions relatively close together in 2000 and 2002, which took a different approach to this question of whether amendments to agreements are effective unless they're in writing or signed by the parties. And the courts had indicated that an oral variation was possible, provided there was sufficient evidence to establish that the parties had intended to vary the agreement without complying with the anti-oral variation clause. So I'll just deal firstly with this recent, the first of the two cases that we're going to cover, of the Global Motors. And actually, the clarification on the previous legal position was only in obiter comments, which is why the second case we're going to cover of MWB is so important. The Court of Appeal in Global Motors indicated that including a variation clause in a contract won't prevent subsequent variation of the contract orally or by conduct. It wasn't a point that needed to be considered for the purpose of deciding the appeal, but the Court of Appeal, and particularly Lord Justice Beetson, felt it necessary to clarify that the principal starting point in a system, which, despite statutory control and inequality of bargaining power, rests on the assumption that parties to a contract are free to determine for themselves what obligations they will accept, and that it's largely for the parties to a long-term contract to insert into it clauses which deal with the particular problems encountered by those who enter into such contracts. He felt that the earlier case in 2002 of World Online Telecom had taken the correct approach. And what more Bick added to Beetson's judgment was that the governing principle is that of party autonomy, and the principle of freedom of contract entitles parties to agree whatever terms they choose, subject to certain limits imposed by public policy.
This latest decision by the Court of Appeal then, MWB Business Exchange Centres, has clarified the position in relation to anti-oral variation clauses and consolidates the Global Motors obiter comments. In this case, the appellant argued that an oral agreement had been made with the respondent's credit controller to reschedule licence fee payments that were in arrears, and that it had paid £3,500 in accordance with that revised payment schedule. The respondent argued that the oral variation was excluded under the agreement because of an anti-oral variation clause in that contract. Lord Justice Kitchen, in the leading judgment, stated he agreed with Lord Justice Beetson that the decision in World Online Telecom was correct, and it was held that an anti-oral variation clause in a written agreement did not preclude any variation of the agreement, and that the credit controller, in this case, had ostensible authority to agree the proposed payment schedule. The Court of Appeal also held there was good consideration for the oral agreement, on the basis that the respondent obtained a commercial benefit by the appellant remaining a licensee and continuing to occupy the property, and also that the appellant's payment of £3,500 and its promise to make further payments conferred a further benefit on the respondent. The oral agreement was therefore binding on the respondent and remained so whilst the appellant continued to make payments in accordance with the revised payment schedule, despite the non-oral agreement clause in the written contract.
So what value do we think these oral anti-variation clauses have in the light of these two recent cases?
Well, I think the good news, Jim, is that the Court of Appeal unanimously noted the clauses are going to have practical effect going forwards. They provide a minimum procedure for the parties to follow to vary the contract, and they encourage parties to ensure that any variation is set out, documented and signed off by all the parties, thereby helping to avoid any future disputes between them about what was and was not agreed. I think the case for really complicated long contracts is that the more prescriptive the anti-oral variation clause, the more difficult it will be to prove oral variations of the contract.
So do we think then that we're going to see more claims arising around the variation of contracts?
I think it's unlikely that there's going to be a whole raft of new cases regarding oral variation, because a party's still going to have to prove that there was a valid oral agreement. So you'll still have to show that there was consideration and, you know, the formalities of varying an agreement orally. So just informal discussions will not be sufficient. The position also won't apply where statute requires certain formalities, so in relation to land or where deeds are required, for example. That said, the clarification of the law is welcome because it just represents the common law's endorsement of the concept of freedom of contract.
So you're listening to the Headnote podcast, brought to you by Pinsent Mason's and Outlaw. We're now going to move on to the next topic for this podcast, which is covering one of the key issues relating to commercial frauds. And that's the question of whether to go down the criminal route or the civil route to help recover losses and deal with the situation. Unfortunately, we're still seeing increases in reported frauds, particularly insider frauds, and it's always a challenge how best to respond.
So I think this is an absolutely key issue for parties who are victims of fraud. In our experience, it's whether to go down the criminal civil route is a question which is not necessarily properly considered by victims of fraud. There's a natural tendency, I think, for those who have been subject to fraud to think that they must rush off and notify the prosecuting authorities. Now, there are some situations where there'll be no choice, or very limited choice, where the SFO already involved or where the business itself is in a regulated a sector. But very often, actually, you do have a choice. And I think huge amounts of money can turn on what choice you make, whether to notify the prosecuting authorities and seek a criminal prosecution, persuade them that that should happen, or whether you should go down the civil route, pursue your civil remedies and seek to try to recover the monies first before handing it over to the prosecuting authorities.
Or indeed, to do both.
Indeed, and that's a possibility. So just looking at what are the advantages of going down the criminal route, it's certainly the preferred route, I think, if the wrongdoers are not good for the money. That there would not be very much point in pursuing a civil remedy unless you're going to get compensation damages as a result of that. It's normally considered the criminal route as being far less expensive than civil action. I think generally that's probably true, although we'll come to look at that in more detail, I think, in a moment. It's true also that prosecuting authorities have much wider powers to acquire evidence through such things as search warrants. They have the power to freeze assets of suspected wrongdoers, what's called a restraint order. It sends the strongest message to other potential wrongdoers. So if you're in a business and perhaps been a victim of a supplier or an insider fraud, that's very commonplace. We're seeing a lot of those cases at the moment. You want to send a strong message that this sort of conduct will not be tolerated. And of course, going down the criminal route will send the strongest message there. So it's a prospect of retributive justice, compelling wrongdoers not financially able to repent money, but ensuring that they are subject, hopefully, to a criminal conviction. Of course, a criminal conviction can also be relied on subsequently in any civil action. There is still potential under the criminal route to receive some compensation from sums confiscated after trial. I think another advantage is that the prosecuting authorities will have better contacts with foreign enforcement agents to the extent that the assets of the wrongdoer are located abroad. So those are, I think, are the primary advantages of going down the criminal route.
There are, however, some disadvantages to the criminal route, and just quickly running through those, there isn't an automatic right to an investigation and then a prosecution. And I think this all comes under the heading of the fact that claimants in criminal proceedings do not have a lot of control over the process, and the choice over whether the investigation takes place and thereafter whether the prosecution is brought is not the choice of the victim. It's up to the law enforcement agencies and the CPS. In terms of obtaining some compensation, it is a requirement that a conviction will be required, and there is quite substantial delay usually, particularly if the if the person that's being accused of the crime decides to not plead guilty. You also have a loss of control over publicity if the police want to use the particular crime for their own purposes. And there is also the issue over ensuring that the independent that the investigation of the police is carried out independently, which is very important to avoid any defence of abuse of process when it actually gets to a trial.
So I'm just going to just briefly summarise some of the advantages of the civil action, having looked at the criminal advantages and disadvantages. The civil action certainly gives you much more control over the position, because the prosecuting authority's primary objective is to get a prosecution. They obviously are minded to have regard to the victim's business and position, but it's not primarily about getting compensation for a victim, whereas civil actions are. And of course, there are significant powers which are available to someone who's going down the civil route, who's guilty, who's been the victim of fraud. There is wide ancillary relief available, including freezing injunctions, search and seize orders. There's more flexibility in terms of some of the remedies available, in terms of potential targets. For example, in civil proceedings, there are proprietary remedies where misappropriated assets can be identified and traced against individuals who knowingly assisted or received the fraud proceeds. I think there is, as we've touched on, an incentive for a fraudster to settle early in the hope of avoiding a subsequent criminal prosecution. There is certainly a much greater prospect of recovering financial losses if you go down the civil route, because compensation orders in a criminal prosecution are more problematic, and there's often issues about actually enforceability of those compensation orders. So if getting your money back is your key objective, we would almost always advise go down the civil route first. It's also quicker, it tends to be quicker than a criminal prosecution, and there's a lower burden of evidential burden of proof, so you only have to show on a balance of probability rather than the higher criminal burden, which is beyond reasonable doubt.
As ever, there are some disadvantages, and I think we would recognise that the civil route is likely to be more expensive, because if you take the criminal route, the cost and the effort is going to be borne by the law enforcement agencies who you've reported the crime to. That said, it's always a balancing act on a cost-benefit analysis whether the better recovery of losses in the civil route is going to outweigh the comparatively cheap criminal route. And the other comparative point is that from a retribution perspective, the criminal route is going to send a far stronger message to the market, whether it's to customers, suppliers, employees, that you take fraud seriously and are prepared to act on them to protect your rights and interests.
It's certainly true, Andrew. I would agree that the criminal route will also attract greater publicity. Now, that's a two-edged sword, because you might want that to send a strong signal to others that you won't tolerate this behaviour and this is what will happen. But equally, of course, the criminal route will involve greater publicity of the failings of one's own control systems, because obviously of any fraud in any business, there has been a failure of those control systems. And so there is the potential for embarrassment. But nevertheless, that is just one of many factors. A lot will depend on your local police force, economic crime agency, because they do vary in quality. If recovery of money is the key driver, then in most cases, it's going to be the civil route first and then handing over to the prosecuting authorities after that's been concluded.
Well, we hope you found this edition of Headnote interesting and informative, and we hope you download the next edition coming soon. Thanks very much for listening.